In an essay in the journal Orion, Eric Ries writes about camping alone for a week on a remote and wild island near the Canada border up in Maine. In and out of descriptions of that particular beautiful slice of the planet, Ries weaves mournful reflections about how much damage we human beings have done to the Earth, especially those of us in the Western industrialized world. Ries writes, "It seems that we have done a very poor job learning the art of being and of allowing others to be, namely the 1.8 million or so other species with whom we share the planet." He goes into some detail on the enormous and entwined problems of overpopulation, overconsumption, pollution, and the destruction of other species' habitat. And he finally concludes, "The root of our most modern sin is that we do not love the world enough." I reread that essay a month or two ago when I realized I would be here with you on Earth Day. It is, of course, not an accident that Earth Day was planted right in the heart of the springtime. In the grace of warmth and the extraordinary flood of color and scent and birdsong that pours out around us every spring. Where I live, up in Boston, spring is still just a nice idea. It has been excruciatingly slow this year. So as green things are finally starting to push up from the ground and here and there push out from the limbs of trees, we are really paying attention. Whether there up north or here where you're much further along in the spring, in that paying attention, surely we are loving the earth. But I wonder, prompted by Ries, whether we love it enough. And I wonder, what might it mean if we could love the world enough? In 1970, when April 22nd was first named as Earth Day, it was, in a sense, the kickoff for what has become the modern environmental movement. It was from that movement that some immense and important changes were made. Some things that have been in place now for so long we can almost take them for granted. The Clean Air Act, the Clean Water Act, the ban on DDT and other chemicals, eventually, in many places, mandatory recycling and much higher standards for emissions. Some incredible things were achieved, and it is important to notice and to honor and to celebrate the difference those things have made, because, for one thing, they remind us what we're capable of. There were also important things left out of that movement almost 50 years ago. One of the most critical is that almost no attention was paid to what can only be called environmental racism. One dimension of that is that we human beings are not all equal in the damage that we cause. Pollution caused by the extractive industries in particular, coal and oil and gas and mining of all kinds, has fallen with enormous weight, especially on indigenous communities who have caused almost none of it and have reaped almost none of the benefits. Closer to home, all over our own country, we can see the dimensions of environmental racism in the fact that the most polluting industries, with the least regulation, were lodged in communities of color, where they still, to the large extent, remain. Although these things are spoken of and are named more often today than they were 50 years ago, they are still often ignored in white communities and in the halls of power. It's interesting to wonder what things might be like in the environmental movement today if some of these things had been noted and acted on back then. When Earth Day was first launched, there could have been a great convergence between new care for the Earth and new care for the most fragile human communities. Instead, in that space, there was a great silence. At the time of the first Earth Day, there were also very few voices raised, even among the most ardent environmentalists, to sound the alarm about melting ice caps and rising sea levels. We could grasp the dangers of toxic smoke or heavy metals in our water, but the concept of planet-wide climate change was so vast, and the dates threatened were so far in the future, way into the 21st century. And now here we are, way into the 21st century. Each anomalous shift of temperature, each extended drought or 500-year flood, every weird and out-of-season tornado remind us that things are badly out of balance. At least once a week, it seems, there's a news story that tells us the ice is shrinking, the currents are shifting, the temperatures are rising faster than what was predicted only a couple of years ago. It is hard to take in. There is a powerful human tendency to not want to see or know or feel what is painful. We are all together in this. It is part of how we're wired. And so there is anguish in knowing how imperiled are the coral reefs, the honeybees, the polar bears, the bats, even the lovely little peepers, which here and even in New England are one of the first sounds of spring. There is anguish in facing these changes. In his book, The Bridge at the Edge of the World, Gus Speth writes, "It is easy to push the challenges out of one's mind because dwelling on such disturbing material is painful. Indeed, one still hears with regularity that it is a mistake to stress these gloomy and doomy realities if one wants to motivate people. People have told me, for example," he writes, "that Martin Luther King Jr. did not proclaim, 'I have a nightmare.' My reply to them is that he did not need to say it. His people were already living a nightmare. They needed a dream. But we, I fear, are living a dream. We need to be reminded of the nightmare. We will never do the things that are needed unless we know the full extent of our predicament." I agree with Speth on that one. But for me at least, I have found that if I am going to face the nightmare and act on it, act somehow as I can on climate change and climate injustice, then I also need the dream. I also need a vision. The courage and the steadfastness that we need have got to be anchored in the reality of what is. But they are sustained through time, not by fear and certainly not by despair, but by love. Our love of the earth, our love for the human family, despite all the ways we have gone off the rails. One place in which I find that love strengthened is when I listen to the voices of the people who are right out on the front lines of what is happening, people for whom climate change, for years now, has not been a distant idea, but an extremely present reality. They are the people of the Carteret Islands in the South Pacific, already having to relocate to places far from their ancestral homes, because the salt water is sifting into all of the places where they grow their food, rendering the land sterile. They are indigenous communities in Alaska, people who have been ignored and marginalized for many decades, but whose voices are now being raised as they watch their land vanish. They are peasant people in Central America who watch coffee crops decimated by diseases like coffee rust that were once held in check by the cool mountain temperatures. Cool no longer. They are poor communities of color in Houston, Texas, where the toxicity of the water that poured through their homes last fall in the wake of Hurricane Harvey has still not been measured. There are threads that link those disparate communities that are located all around the world. One thread is that the communities are indisputably experiencing right now, today, the consequences of climate change, and are, without exception, populations that have done the least to cause it. Another thread is their determination to have control over the choices that remain to them, the choices they now face, rather than once again have entrenched and often colonial powers choose solutions that do not make sense and in some cases make the problems worse. A third thread that connects all of these communities is that they are actively seeking allies among people of conscience who want to be of use. They are not casting blame. They are reaching out their hands in solidarity. And another thread, one that gives me a thrill of hope, is that the Unitarian Universalist Service Committee is supporting grassroots indigenous organizing in all of the communities that I named. This coming September, as just one example, the people of Shivak, Alaska, will host their counterparts from the other side of the planet, from the South Pacific Carteret Islands. These indigenous communities on opposite sides of the globe will meet together for the first time because of UUSC. And from their gathering, they will then choose and declare the agenda for advocacy and action that they want us as allies to assist with. No matter where we live, there are neighborhoods and communities bearing more than their share of the burden of climate change. One way that we can stay courageous and determined and committed is to find out where they are choosing to push against what's coming and put our shoulders there next to them, following their lead. Hope, at least for me, arises most often when I can put myself to use. And even when the problems are this large, there are places people are calling for us to come and stand and be of use. That is one part, I think, of what it means to love the world enough. But another part is held in what Clint Smith lifted up in our reading this morning. It is to dig our bare feet into the soil and see all of the ways in which the world continues to give birth to itself. To see, in his words, and to remember how the leaves have always become the soil that then becomes the leaves again. How maybe we are not so different from the leaves. How maybe we are also always being reborn, to be something more than we once were. And so this week, although the spring is so slow and so cold, I took myself off into the woods that are closest for me, living as I do in Boston. And there in this large area preserved to the trees and the life there, I walked past trees not yet leafing out, yet the moss beneath them turning an almost impossible shade of green, past the vernal puddles in the middle of the track, full of clear water the color of strong tea, where small, quick salamanders bask in the sun that comes down through the water to touch them, past the tired old leaves that are lying there in the tracks, and where I find the earliest spring butterflies, the size of my thumbnail and the most brilliant color of blue, that I can sometimes coax off of the papery leaves and onto my warm finger for just a split second before they fly off again. Past the little ponds where at least four distinct kinds of frog songs come trilling, lilting, chirping, and belching out. Past a misplaced crocus blooming its brave and cultivated purple way out there in the middle of the woods as though believing itself a wildflower. And past a stunning clump of wild hepatica, cradled in the hollow of an old oak tree, held there like some enormous grizzled old man might cradle a newborn baby. The woods are full of these beautiful, comforting signs of new life. And also there, I passed the matted, pasted fur of a possum winter killed, and found the delicate, pure white bones of a mouse scattered across the moss, and touched a log, a tree fallen so long ago that now this spring, after our long, wet winter, it has finally disintegrated completely, still holding itself in this russet outline against the ground, but truly dissolved now into earth, feeding what once fed its own life. And I stop and lift a handful of it, what was once a flowing trunk raising a whole canopy to the sky, and it crumbles in my hand, undeniably gone back to the earth from which it first rose. How do we love the world enough? We take our own sorrows, our own fears out there into the life of the planet, which is also death, where we see that everything is this way. We rise, we shine, we fall again, and when we do, we are caught and held in the life of this earth, like the shining wildflowers in the hollow of an old oak tree. People have conversion experiences and epiphanies all the time. Can an entire society have a conversion experience? I don't know. But I know what it would look like. It would be a completely different orientation toward what we mean by words like success. Success cannot mean bigger or more or richer. It has to mean less stuff, greater wisdom, finding joy in one another's joy rather than in winning out over each other. The focus on individual wants and preferences has got to yield to a sense of solidarity, and the long habit in the Western world of seeing ourselves as somehow outside of nature, in control of it, has got to yield to the truth about our place in things. We don't live on the earth. We are the earth, as every other thing is the earth. Billions of pieces of it, rising and falling and rising again, occasionally rising as we have arisen, with eyes and hands and minds and will and courage, with the capacity to love, maybe even to love enough. William Stafford, in his poem, Starting with Little Things. Love the earth like a mole, fur near, nearsighted. Hold close the clods, their fine print headlines. Pat them with soft hands, like spades, but pink and loving. They break rock, nudge giants aside. Affable plow. Fields are to touch. Each day, nuzzle your way. Tomorrow, the world. Amen.